Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast, How Connectivity Solves the Technical Challenges of IoT, Rise of the Robot Overlords, Clarifying the Industrial IoT, Part 7 of our series. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Stan Schneider of Real-Time Innovation. This series is presented by Stan Schneider, CEO of Real-Time Innovation. With over 1,300 designs, RTI is the largest of the IIoT connectivity framework vendors. RTI software runs the largest power plants in North America, connects perception controls in vehicles, coordinates combat management in U.S. Navy ships, drives a new generation of medical robotics, controls Hyperloop and flying cars, and provides 24/7 medical intelligence to hospital patients and emergency victims. Stan also serves as the vice chair of the Industrial Internet Consortium Steering Committee. The IIC is the largest of the industrial IoT consortia with over 250 members. Stan serves on the advisory board for the industry's largest event, the IoT Solutions World Congress. He received Embedded Computing Design's Top Embedded Innovator Award in 2015 and was ranked number 8 in IoT One's Top 100 IIoT Influencers in 2017. Stan completed a PhD and EE in Computer Science at Stanford with a thesis on autonomous systems at Stanford Aerospace Robotics Laboratory. Today's schedule consists of approximately 50 minutes of presentation. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your viewing console. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows you can open, close, move, or resize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see windows titled Presenter, Speaker, Bio, Sponsor, and Slides, where the presentation will be displayed, and a Q&A window that enables you to ask questions during the event. There are a set of 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. You can click on the icon at the far left, and it will reset your viewing area. The rest of these icons will open and close your corresponding windows. You can hover your mouse over each window to show which window controls what. Clicking the handout icon, second from the right, opens a handout window which has the slides today in PDF format. You can use those to follow along with or download for future reference. The Q&A window enables you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the Ask a Question text box and hit Submit. Ask those questions during the event. We'll try to address as many as we can during the closing Q&A if we have time. And if you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help you. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. On with the show. Stan, part 7.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the introduction. Unfortunately, due to the length of the introduction, we're out of time now, so no, I'm kidding. This is part 7 of my Rise of the Robot Overlords presentation. My title was The Age of Smart Machines. I'm trying to give you a little view of where I think the future is going from our perspective. If you haven't been following along, I will quickly repeat the story that sort of started this whole thing. So I suppose it's 3 years ago now. I have a kid at the time. He was, I think, 9th grade. He came in with not such a great report card. Actually told, what do you want to do with your life? And he looked up at me, and he looked down at our dog sleeping on the floor. He said, Dad, I want to be a pet of the robot overlords. And at the time, I was, like, just shocked. That's my legacy. I want to be a pet of the robot overlords. And I tried to talk him out of it, realized pretty quickly that he was right. Everybody's going to be a pet of the robot overlords. And if that's his ambition to leverage the best technology of his era, I think that's a great idea. So I do think that the world is changing very quickly, and it's a huge disruption coming, and the greatest disruption in the history of technology, really. Not an understatement at all. And basically, if you have kids today that are, high school age or younger, your children will not drive, they will not write, they will not compose music. They'll not make buying decisions, or at least they won't have to, because the technology is coming along very quickly, and there's already computing systems that are challenging human abilities in all of those areas. And the reason for that is really two reasons. There's an amazing increase and an exponential increase in the rise of computing. And if you think Moore's Law is going to end, I've been hearing that my entire career, that Moore's Law is going to end soon. I don't buy it, but even if it just slows down by a factor of 2 or 4 or 10, there's still going to be an amazing increase in performance of computing. And parallel thing having the same time is connectivity is becoming much easier and all the devices are getting connected. And, you know, if you take, actually, we're now calling it Girardot's Law, that the power of the network is the capability of the nodes times the square of the number of things that are connected, that sort of puts together two nodes, two different laws out there. It really is a stunning change in the technology of the world. And really what it's bringing along is this thing that we call the smart machine era. And RTI has a unique place here. We live at the intersection of what I call functional artificial intelligence. I'll define that a little bit better, and pervasive networking. They're really the two biggest trends in technology today. It's in a very inspiring moment to be here. As the largest connectivity vendor, we have a really good view of all these different things. We have experience in about 1,300 designs out there. Many of them are deployed. Most of them actually are not yet deployed. They're still working on them. So we have a lot of view of the future. RTI is by far the largest of the connectivity vendors out there in this space. We're involved in an increasing and amazing array of consortia and applications. I'm going to talk about sort of what that all, what view that gave us. But I want to start with just some perspective. I mean, if you look back now and try to wonder what life was like without electricity or without cars or without fire, for that matter, it's really hard to imagine what things could be like. And it won't be that long from now that everybody just expects everything around them to be smart, efficient, intelligent, and help the world get along. It really isn't that true today, but it's coming quickly, and it's going to be an amazing disruptive force. And it also is going to be a huge economic impact. I mean, I've got a collection of slides with impact the IoT. You know, it's, one says $19 trillion there. They all say a different amount of money, but they all agree on one thing, that it's in the trillion. Definitely is hype cycles coming down a little bit, but there's still nobody doubts the impact the smart machines will have on the world. The problem is, you know, you look at this the state, and, you know, in my big picture, this is space, obviously. This isn't the big picture. I don't know what is. But, you know, space, one thing you learn about it, if you spend any time at all thinking about it, it's big. It's really immensely big. It's mind-bogglingly big, and you can't really grasp how all the different galaxies in the world are. The IoT is same kind of thing. It's not really one application. It may be a $10 trillion market, but it really is $10 million markets. That's the big challenge out there. There's just so many different things going on. Some things are moving faster than others. This, by the way, is the IIC's vertical taxonomy. And, you know, if you just look at the industries that will be impacted by smart things, it's everything. Really is complete change in the way that the world executes as pervasive, and maybe even more pervasive than computing or networking was. It's not as fast, but it's very much everywhere. But I don't want to spend too much time on that. If you've been following along, this is the seventh of the Robot Overlords series. I sort of promised the age of the Robot Overlords a view into the future as we see it, and how the world is changing in a lot of ways. And I'll focus on a few different industries there. I actually had started out thinking I was just going to spend my entire hour showing you videos. I have a whole bunch of videos. Unfortunately, the platform doesn't support videos with this many people, so I had to cut the videos, and we will take a tour on slides instead. I want to start with power generation. We have an obvious problem right now. Today, virtually all power is produced, or most power is produced by burning something. Burning fuel has actually got lots of problems. They're pretty well known with carbon generation and pollution. And it's just not as simple as you might think to stop doing that, because the whole grid and all the power systems is designed with this central generation in mind, where you have big sources of power with very clean outputs that are controlled by some central station and distributed out to all the users. And the new reality is really called DER, distributed energy resources, where you take batteries and photovoltaics and wind turbines and have them out in the field, not in one big place. They're much more environmentally friendly, but they're also much harder to control. The way to control those, you really have to have some high-performance distributed information flow. And if you've been following around, you know, we call that a data bus. A data bus makes it easy to sort of have a view of all the different information in the system at many different layers. And I've talked a lot about the technology, how that works, and why it's important, but I thought I'd show you a recent example of how pervasive it can make in a change in the world. And I'm going to do it with a technology from Indra called InGrid. It's just released, so it's relatively new. There is a link there at the bottom, by the way, of the video. If you want to see the video, I'm going to step through the video here. Before that, let me give you a little background on our dealings with Indra. So Indra is a big company. I think they've got some like 40,000 people in many different areas. We've been working with them for a decade or more in several areas, in security and defense and air traffic control. They're one of the largest air traffic control provider equipment providers, and more recently in energy. So they sort of adopted the data-centric mantra, or drank the data-centric Kool-Aid, another way to look at it. And it really does provide a different way of looking at the world. And, you know, I think it's really important that they're a good example that of the power of an architecture that spans industries, because you can sort of learn this way to handle data and apply it to new areas. So this product is a grid control product, and I just want to give you an idea of the breadth of the challenge of the problem. So obviously you have safety and security to deal with. Quality of service, it has to work all the time. It has to be very high performance. It's really smart grids trying to put together distributed energy resources and power flow analytics in real time, so it must control the world. It can't spend a lot of money on it, so it's got to work with lots of different kinds of devices, and ideally inexpensive devices. And then all the things you have to do. You have to manage all these assets in the field if you're a utility or something like that. There's a lot of different kinds of assets, and assets are equipment as well as things like operators and all this kind of thing. You can't just put the system out in the field trying to build a whole city that's going to be controlled, or a subsection of the city. You have to have a planning facility, and planning is a big part of actually implementing the grid. Integrated planning is hard. Don't forget about maintenance. Once it's up and running, you have to have integration with the maintenance systems and the development, and also with the distribution management. Distribution management is the ability to do things like, request some of your large users to back off a little bit when power is expensive, so factories could burn less power or something like that. It really allows you to control and manage the grid in a much more sane way. Then you got to be able to, when things go wrong, dispatch field service to work on it. There's all sorts of KPIs and indicators, opportunities, what's going on. It has to be real time. You're acquiring data, integrating information, understanding what's really going on out there, so you can put together future changes and know where you're getting your power. And then don't forget the basics, like, you have to train your operators. How do you train the operators? It's really this is a fairly typical industrial IoT system. It's much larger than people think it is. It's not just rolling power. And then he wanted to run on, you know, laptops and big displays and mobile platforms and all sorts of things like that. And it, you know, can get large. They're also doing financial transactions and millions of daily transactions and analysis and edge computing architecture, so you can present that to your investors and things like that. They've got thousands of assets to monitor and control out there. It's a big system, and of course it has to be available to run 24/7, no matter what's going on. And you know, it really is trying to make the IoT a reality. And I'm putting this up here because this isn't just a theoretical system. If you actually look at how most people, most electrical power organizations are selling technology and planning for the future, I would argue this system is a decade ahead of anybody else. It's what is in their vision, but this isn't just theoretical. This is actually running. I have an example here of one of their first installations, a place in Australia called Monash University, which is a big university, has a huge advantage. The university owns everything, so they can control everything going on, and their goal is to, you know, get to net zero carbon emissions and you know, really build a future grid there. This is a great slide of how they do this. Data flow requirements. You might notice that the slide uses what we've been calling the layered data bus, with shared information and a consistent data architecture from all the way down the field devices inside the substations to the higher level substations, all the way up to the generators. All one consistent, easy to access data space. So it makes it much easier to do things like, you know, integrate in with the service organizations and the planning and everything else, if you actually can get that data available across the system at any time. And obviously, at the bottom, you got very high-speed data. I love their graph here with the data volume. Things at the bottom are very high. At the top, it's not so high, but you need a lot of smart. So that's sort of what I mean by integrating functional artificial intelligence with pervasive networking. And then, you know, the implementation they have, I think, is years ahead of others. This is their diagram. Sort of looks like the ISA's three-tier diagram, except for this thing in the middle that they call unified data space. This data space enables sort of system-wide integration on a level that's just not possible if you have 15 different protocols and different kinds of access to information throughout the system. So they've been able to really take advantage of that technology. They certainly aren't the only ones. It's a real commercial product, but we have many other generators especially that are doing this. Grand Coulee is the largest power plant in North America. I've talked about that in one of my talks. And Siemens Wind Power is the world's largest producer of wind turbines, is also a customer. And we're working with many different organizations trying to build standards. The sort of biggest one out there is something called OpenFMB. If you haven't heard of it and you're in the power industry, I suggest you go take a look at it. They're really building, driven by Duke Energy originally, is building an architecture for the future of field grids. I used to call it DER integration. Used to call it microgrids, sort of not really description anymore. Second thing, you know, automotive. You know, everybody knows the problems with commuting and dangers of commuting, and it's been a dream forever to have autonomous drive. I actually pulled up some historical stuff just for fun. So this is, you know, 1918 Scientific American picture of an autonomous car. You notice the people in the car aren't driving. They're doing other things with their time in life. It really is a nice thing. Here's one that I was told is even earlier than that. The 1831 is before they even had the first cars at the turn of the century. But I like this picture for lots of reasons. It sort of predicts many of the problems out there. So, for instance, there's pollution from the cars pumping out lots of dirt, and there's traffic. And you notice this guy in the bottom right is all angry at the car in front of him. So they even predicted road rage, which I think is an interesting thing. But really, you know, that vision of traffic and pollution really is not there. People ask all the time, well, how long is it going to take for autonomous vehicles to catch on? And the technology, if a great technology comes along, it, it happens faster than you might think to change what's going on. So this is a picture of Easter parades in New York City at the turn of the century. And you notice on the left there, there's only one motor vehicle. And you can't really see it in this picture, but that car has a safety horse, like today's autonomous car. I'm supposed to be laughing. That's funny. Now, maybe they didn't have a horse that could pull the car if it failed. But then, only 13 years later, 10 years later, there's only one horse, one carriage with a horse. And it really is a huge change. When technologies come along that really make a difference in people's lives, they impact the world very, very quickly. So, and this technology has a huge opportunity to do that. I found some data here on the safety of cars. Cars today are 45. You're 44. This is from Europe, but you're 44 times more likely to die per mile anyway in a car than you are in a plane, and 520 times more likely in a motorcycle. So I encourage you not to ignore that. My younger brother is actually a neuropsychologist who works with people with brain trauma, and 75% of his patients are motorcycle accidents. I will encourage you to think about that. Here's the U.S. data here, and you'll see that while the deaths per vehicle mile traveled, which is the red line at the bottom, are dropping off pretty substantially, especially in early days, but as we increase all the safety components of vehicles, the deaths overall have been stubborn. I actually worked in this industry for years back in the 80s and early 90s, and back then it was something like 45,000 a year. This graph actually ends in 2016 or 15. 2016 and 2017 were both about 40,000, so it really hasn't gotten much better. It's sad how little has changed. And that's despite lots of researchers, including myself, working very hard trying to make this happen. And, we have multi-stage airbags and analog brakes and electronic stability control and better roads and car seats and crumple zones and crash structures and collapsible steering columns and side impact protection and on and on and on, and any drunk driving laws and any distraction laws, and all of these things together just aren't going to make a difference. And I see that as an absolutely huge problem. People see every time there's a car called autonomous cars, car bots, but every time there's an accident, it makes front page news for many, many days, but it's just not the way to look at it. The human driver accidents are so common, they don't even make the news. You can't even find them if you pick up your local paper. In the Bay Area, something like 30 to 60 people die every week in the Bay Area on the roads, and you won't even find that reported. It really is a sad state of affairs, and human error accounts for 94% of road accidents. It's really, in my humble opinion, it's a moralistically unacceptable situation. And so I believe that we have a moral obligation to automate driving. I don't think there's any other way to make it work. You'll see lots of arguments out there of the morals of autonomous drive cars, and if the car is put into a position where it has to decide if it's going to kill you or run over the sidewalk full of kindergartners, what's it going to do? And I would argue that that's the wrong question, because if you were in that situation driving on the road and suddenly a semi comes into your lane and you've got to either hit the semi or drive off the road, what are you going to do? Too late. You've already made your decision, if you even had time to make a decision. At least autonomous car has a chance to make that choice. And whatever choice it makes, that's an extremely rare situation. I give talks on autonomous driving all the time, and I ask people if they've ever been in a moral decision like that. I think I've only had one person raise their hand in the entire time. On the other hand, I also ask, raise your hand if you've have a relative or friend that was injured or killed in a car crash, and it's typically about a third of the room. It is just the moral imperative is to automate driving and make it safer. It's also better for efficiency. I will make another prediction here. Within 10 or 15 years, today's high occupancy vehicle lanes, carpool lanes, will be autonomous only because they are able to travel safely at higher speeds with closer spacing. And closer spacing is actually safer because you have less delta velocity when you hit. And autonomous cars, even autonomous cars version 1.0 will be a better driver than you are, and 2.0 will be a better driver than I am. And yeah, yes, that's a joke, but I think I'm a better driver than average, just like you do. I think this is something that can really make the world better in a short period of time. I also think it's a huge business issue. The auto industry is my poster child for the change in the competitive space in the business world. For decades, it's competed on things like style and experience and motor performance. And virtually one of my other favorite questions in front of an auto audience is, raise your hand if your supervisor has a background in software. Almost never. Lately, I've got a couple, but almost never the management chain have any experience in software. They have experience usually in mechanical engineering or styling or motor engineering or engine engineering. That's a term, or finance. But the future is really going to turn into software, and the best software is going to win, at least for this near future. I think it's really going to turn into change the very basis of competition, which is unbelievably disruptive to the industry. RTI's got lots of experiences. We have something like 40 autonomous vehicles of various types. Our platform, I think that makes us the number one platform out there, including some of the other kinds of platforms like ROS and AutoStar are now picking DDS standards. So we do have some experience in that world. And it's not just cars. We're also working with flying cars, which I think is an exciting and new thing. I don't think it's as big of a change to the world as autonomous cars. Trains that are much smarter is going to make them much more efficient and able to carry freight and things around. We also work with some of the new designs for integrated city management with metro transit, which I think is an opportunity to make the world much more efficient. And then Hyperloop. And Hyperloop is something I think is, everybody's heard of it now, but I think it's really misunderstood what it is. It isn't the train, and it isn't the plane, and it isn't the car, and it sort of has characteristics of all of those things. There's a great video out there, but the Hyperloop to me is very fast. All the designs that I've seen, Hyperloop One here are very green. It's amazingly efficient. It's all electrical powered. They charge up a big capacitor or battery at one end, and they fire the vehicle off, and it's not powered during the long transit. There's almost no friction because there's almost no air in the tube. At the other end, they decelerate and they regenerate the electricity, so they get almost all of it back or a lot of it back, and they fire something back the other direction at the same time it's coming in. It's not like they're just one of these in the tube at a time. They can plug them in the tube at very high speeds. I'm not allowed to tell you how fast they can do it, but think of it more like a machine gun than like a train that leaves every half hour. And it's going to transform things in ways I think people don't understand. The obvious thing, would you rather fly or take the loop here? And, there's no turbulence in turn. There's no air in the tubes. So there's no turbulence. There's no air in the tubes, so there's no noise. No air noise at all once you're moving. It doesn't have any carbon emissions. So if you want to do that, you don't have to go find an airport. There's no four-hour drive to park at the airport between both ends. You can go from city center to city center. The only thing that really they have in common is there's likely to be a Starbucks at the entrance for both of these, so you get your caffeine. And a Hyperloop, you can take it with you and get on, and it won't even spill on the very, at least after the initial acceleration, which isn't going to be much more than an airplane, by the way, or even more at all. It just lasts longer, gets you up to speeds of 700 miles an hour. And so, you know, if you actually think about it, it's not a multi-point thing. It's the closest analogy to what a Hyperloop is a wormhole. It really just takes two different parts of the world and makes them suddenly almost the same. You can get from one to the other. I have a couple of examples out there. The first one, real, Heathrow Airport needs another runway. If you're in the UK, you know all about this. The problem is, you know, to build a third runway at Heathrow and get the real estate and everything else, the estimates that I found online the other day are £14 billion, and that's a lot of money to build another runway, and it's difficult to do. Now, Gatwick Airport, which is about a 40-minute drive away, without traffic, but in traffic, an hour or 2 hours, you really need 4 hours in your transfer time to make that safely. It has lots of space and lots of runway space. And so the thought is, well, why not just put a Hyperloop? And there's a proposal out there to build a Hyperloop. And if you see, it actually also between Stansted. But Heathrow to Gatwick here is 5 minutes. 5 minutes, that's probably less than the interterminal train today at Heathrow. I mean, it's amazingly fast. It logically takes Heathrow and Gatwick and makes them the same airport. And other kinds of applications, you think it's replacing a train, really aren't the same thing. California has a problem with affordable housing. And today, I know Vanessa drives an immense distance to come work at this wonderful place we call RTI. 50 miles every day, and what does it take you? An hour and a half? So, you know, if that could be 7 minutes, and you could, San Francisco could be located up in the Oregon Forest, San Jose, and you can actually connect these city centers with affordable housing spaces. Now, there's environmental issues with now you're going to open the wilderness, but it certainly takes a completely different view of real estate. And just like all order of magnitude changes in transportation technology have completely changed the way people work, completely changed the way people think of things. You know, 100 years ago before cars, Vanessa couldn't live 50 miles away from where she works. It's insane, right? And a horse, that's a two-day travel. I'm not a horse expert, but it's a long trip. It's something you'd really have to think through to do. But today, that's practical or barely practical. But tomorrow, it might be completely practical to, get in your subdivision of 100 square miles on the Oregon Forest with a view of the ocean, have an autonomous car pick you up, take you in that car on the Hyperloop, show up downtown L.A. 12 minutes later, 5 minutes later, and drop you off at work, and now your commute is only 30 minutes, and you can live in a very different kind of environment. This kind of change is coming in many different areas in the transportation space. It's really an exciting time to think about the potential. And then I'm going to end with the medical market because it's, I think, most scary in a lot of ways. So hospital era, the Institute of Medicine came out a few years ago and declared hospital the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. And, you know, one of the reasons, many reasons for that, but one of the reasons is the equipment can't help care team. It just doesn't know that things are going on. So if you look at this, it's an operating, typical operating theater here. It's not a heart bypass operation, but, you know, I think there's 42 devices in that picture that have computers in them. Some of them have, 10, 15 computers in them, but they don't talk to each other at all. They can't check each other up. They can't find out if something's wrong. And because of that, a care team can make a seemingly simple mistake and it's not caught by anything else. Harvard has now surveyed many surgical teams and they've all had that same error along with hundreds and hundreds of other errors. It's just a classic example of something that's too complex for people to ever get rid of all the sources of error. And, it's easy to fix if you can just do what's seemingly simple thing, which is connect the devices together along with some artificial intelligence here called supervisory services that can take the medical instruments and understand that they are talking to the same patient and they're trying to take care of that patient, get the patient's history. This is a much simpler thing than a surgery, by the way. and make that work. The problem is hospitals don't look like that. Hospitals are much more complicated. This is a simulation we did for GE Healthcare with a 300-room hospital. Their design is for, you know, 1,000-plus rooms and 200,000 to 300,000 devices. Very complex. We'll come back to that in a second, but, you know, many other things, you know, the imaging world is also changing a lot. This is a company called BK Medical. It's a leader in ultrasound. This is their current product, not their future product. And ultrasound systems haven't changed in decades. You know, if you go back and look at the original ones, they're still on wheels. They have keyboards. They have a display like this. They have an attached set of transducers that you can use to get your image, and then you can look at the image. And they're really thinking about, you know, they're building a new system that portable, put it in your pocket. You don't have to go find the machine. You can pull the thing out and do an image right there on the spot and look at it on your phone or in a display on the wall in the clinic. And it's really a transformative thing. And I look for an analogy for that. Now, this has been thought of a long time ago by Star Trek. So if you're a Star Trek fan, you know this Dr. Voyager, but he's got a little device in his hand, and that device sends data out to some local compute center that's going to think about what's going on and gets back and can display right there in his hand with him. Of course, it's also now online, and just like I talked at the beginning about the power system, the power of having all that data available to all layers of the system is huge here. Now, instead of having to give you some physical media like you used to get with a Polaroid picture, and today you still get with a CD or a USB stick. Now it's immediately online. It's immediately available to the cloud and to the care teams out there. And not only that, you know, it scales well. Every doctor can have their own and use it in different situations, and you don't have to go find things. It's just a much better way to do it, much more distributed and much more scalable. And, you know, works also with larger systems. One of our other customers, the imaging division, their Revolution CT is just an amazing machine, you know, something like 50 processors in it all working together, incredibly accurately timed to be able to snap an image and freeze things like a beating heart so they can take a good look at what's going on with the heart and the vessels around it, just really a Star Trek technology. This is an even more Star Trek technology, in my humble opinion, where you can, instead of going in, there's a scene in one of the early Star Trek episodes where Bones gets upset that you cut and sew people like garments. And this is getting to where you don't need to do that. This is takes protons, very high energy protons, and can zap tumors without cutting anything and without the ancillary damage of X-rays that causes on tissue. The protons have much less. The problem is to actually do that, the protons have to be going really fast, about 70% of the speed of light. To do that, you have to have a full superconducting synchrocyclotron particle accelerator that they've shrunk down into something that fits into a single room so you can, and is movable, so you can aim it very accurately in three dimensions. This has actually been running now for quite a while. We have multiple customers doing this kind of thing now. It really is going to change a lot of the way cancer treatment works. We're pretty excited about that. Another big change I can't talk about very much because all the customers here are pretty much stealth mode is a robotic surgery. This is a research class customer we've had for a while. But, we have several of these systems under development here. Will allow surgeons to go in and computer intelligent assist do much more precise things. Some of these devices are now don't look like hands and sticks. They look like things that can sneak around inside your body, and it's just a much more efficient way to get in and do non-invasive interventions and things like that. So that's coming quickly. Maybe even more exciting is the ability to connect the entire care infrastructure with a single data architecture. So if you can pull together all the data architecture, you can make decisions, better decisions, like tell this emergency crew which hospital they should take the patient to by actually analyzing the patient, understanding what might be wrong with the patient, and then taking it to the hospital can handle that best. And by making, you know, in emergency care, every second counts, making that much more efficient. My phone is beeping at me for some reason, which is scary. Maybe the battery's dying. I don't know. And then there's, you know, bigger problems like the grand challenge of fault tolerance. This is actually a diagram of one of our other customers. It is a very, this diagram should strike fear into the heart of every networking person looking at this, because the real issue here is just look at this for a while. Yeah, you could have a failure like you have offer here on the right of a single device, and you got to be able to handle that. That's okay. But you can also have a failure of a whole, you know, ward of devices or something like that. Or maybe you could cut off a whole division.
Dan, have we lost you on mute? Let's see here. I think we'll, Stan might have been cut off here for a second. We'll be right back, audience. If you want to continue to hold here, we'll get him back so he can finish up. Want to remind people that you do have an ask a question box. Hopefully there's a lot of good material. You can continue to ask those questions. Just, go to the ask a question window, type your question, and view submit. If we don't get to the questions, we will certainly have RTI can certainly follow up with you, or you can also reach out to RTI to do that. As we get when we get Stan back here, we will continue with the presentation. Also want to remind people that icon on your bottom second from the right is a slides icon. If you're interested in if you've seen some slides that are relevant for you, you can certainly download the presentation there in PDF format and have that to keep and follow along with as well. Appreciate the audience patience as we get Stan back here. Seem to have an audio problem.
Hello, can you hear me? We apparently had a
good, and you're back.
I'm back. Yeah, great. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Where did you lose me?
You were on
what
the connectivity matters.
So did you lose me on the previous slide or this one?
I think yes, that one, the grand challenge.
Okay. So can you put me back on live? Hi, everybody. We had a phone failure, which is really interesting that that happened while I'm talking about fault tolerance. What are the chances? So sorry about that. Hopefully you can hear me again now. Switch to another phone. So, you know, if you actually look at the challenge presented by a system like this where you have many different possible places of fault, It's amazing. This picture should strike fear in the heart of any networking person. Yeah, you can have small faults like you have here on the right where you lose one device. That's not that big of a deal, but you can also lose on the bottom here, you know, entire subsections, in this case maybe a ward in the hospital. But you can lose the entire floor of a hospital, or you can lose connectivity to big chunks of the system. And even here, this one has possible loss of the central server. So if you have a server based design, this is a big problem. You've really lost things. With a database design, a data centric design, if there's any way to communicate, you can have redundant networks, you can have redundant compute, you can have redundant devices, and all of these things can have many different ways of connecting together. The reason we're able to do things like maybe combat management systems and highly reliable power systems, the same thing you might want in a hospital, to not have failure, system-wide failure when you lose some part of the system. And it really is an amazingly simplifies the code when you're just really working with the data and you allow the infrastructure to make sure that the data sharing is done in any way that's possible with redundant systems that can be much more reliable. And if you do lose the connectivity, all sorts of, you could have a fiber and a wire and a wireless network connecting each device together. And if any one of them works, you're going to get information. It might not be the same rate, but all of your architectures, all of your applications, if they're using the quality service control that DDS offers, can know if they're getting the data they need to be to execute successfully. And if not, they can take remedial action. So it very much simplifies all the work that the applications have to do. They don't have to ping anything or test anything. They just have to know if they're getting the data flow that they need to exist. It just makes life easier to deal with. And so, I love bringing in customers, and medical might be one of my favorite ones. We talk to a lot of customers. We bring them into the company. We have a very active users group meeting. We actually bring them in for our company kickoff and all hands meeting. It's partially to understand what they do and what they need and how much they need and like RTI and our product. But it's not really what I love about talking to all these customers. I want to understand why they do what they do, what their pain and challenge is. So it's really, our customers are all working on things that are really hard. It's not an easy thing. I challenge the company all the time by telling them I think we've chosen the hardest problem in computer science. And you artificial AI people out there might argue and win, but I don't think anybody else is likely to argue and win. These are really hard problems with reliability and redundancy and real time and politics and all these different choices. But what people are doing and what our customers are doing are really matters. We can get better health care, we can get better renewable energy, we can get safer cars, we can be more efficient with defense, we can prevent another Deepwater Horizon, we can take care of your kid and NICU. It really makes a difference. And the thing that really makes that difference is better access to data. Tie together devices, make it reliable, make it scale, handle the corner cases, make it debuggable, deal with the real world systems out there. It really makes an amazing difference. One of our customers actually likened it to, it has to work like you're chopping up a worm. So you chop up a worm, all the pieces still work, and eventually they grow back. It really is, it's a complicated thing like that. It's got to be able to work in that. So I really think it's an inspiring world out there. We actually have a video to take a look at here, the healthcare video, if you want to know it. The video focuses mostly on patient monitoring, because it's sort of a big opportunity, but it's also, a big change in the industry. Patient monitoring has an opportunity to really change the way things work, to use technology to save lives. It has to be secure. It has to be high performance. It has to be very reliable and fault tolerant. But if you can pull that off, there's things you can do out there that can just make a huge difference in the world. I wish I could play this video. Please go take the time to look at this video. Is there another problem? So RTI is in many, many different kinds of applications. The data bus applications really go across the entire space of the IoT. It's a unique view we have, but it's also a nice place to see how the world's changing out there. We can give you a little taste of that. We have a users group meeting, I suppose, that we call ConnexCon. These are all organizations that have spoken at ConnexCon. There's a few more that are on here now. Almost all of them have data out there on our community site, which is different than our marketing, www.rti.com, called community.rti.com. This may well be the industry's biggest use case repository. If you want to go out there and take a look at all the different kinds of things you can do with connectivity and intelligence and industrial and other things, I would encourage you to go take a look at some of these use cases out there. You might want to ask how can all of this work, and that I will say is what I've been saying for a while. All you have to do to get all these benefits is change everything about how you think. It's a complete change. It sounds like it's not, but it really is. You got to put data in the center, build the whole system around that data. My new favorite way to explain it is I think of, it acts like all the data, the entire system, anything you might want, any speed you might want it, any time you might want it is available on every device. This is really the core concept of data centricity. It's not instant, but it's instant in quotes at the rate you need or want it to anything anywhere in the system at any time really is what data centricity is all about. And then, you've heard our tagline, but systems are all about the data, data-centric steering, lets them cooperate. They're decoupled because they don't interact with each other in ways you don't expect. And that's where our tagline, systems working as one, comes from. We spent a lot of time in this series talking about, you don't want to, these kinds of connectivity technologies do not overlap much. They don't compete. Your goal is not to evaluate DDS versus OPC UA versus MQTT because it's very unlikely your application will succeed with any one of those. It's likely it fits into one of them. So we spend a lot of time trying to help people figure out where it fits. If you don't fit our market, our questions, we don't want you. No offense. It's just not, we're not going to be able to fix your problems, right? We're a software engineering environment that's fast and, very good at failures and large, deeply distributed systems as opposed to just collecting data in one place. We do think this probably describes 80% of the use cases today, not 100%. But 80% of them are somehow in advanced transportation systems in those areas, not all areas, and energy, mostly all renewables, but also in some automated drilling and production, robotic drilling and production, medical in three areas, connected devices, robotics, and big devices, and defense, mostly in distributed sensing systems, the defense side of defense, not the offense side of defense. If you do any of those things, you really should be taking a look at how DDS worked. So this is the last of the series. I was going to summarize it. I decided I'm going to have a single slide. If you missed one of these, I'll give you a quick overview of what's in them. So part one is really about what the IoT is anyway. I think it divides into three very different classes of applications where you got a single device talking to a single cloud service. You got a lot of devices. That's device monitoring. You got a lot of devices where you're collecting data and getting up to the cloud to optimize them. And then, we call edge autonomy where the action is between devices outside of a data center. Data center might be involved with your data bus architecture, but that's really what we talk about here. Selecting IoT connectivity, as I just said, is not a pair one against another. It's really figure out what galaxy you're in. And if you're in one of these galaxies, clearly you absolutely should use that. If you're close to one of them, you probably should use the one that's closest. If there's lots of applications that are what I call interstellar space, you really are going to be on your own. You're going to have to make something new. Most applications are not in interstellar space. Most applications are close to something out there. DDS doesn't do everything. And despite the hype you hear, OPC UA doesn't do everything, and neither does MQTT do everything. They do different things for different applications, and your goal, if you're choosing one of these, should be to understand them enough that you can make that choice, not compare them against things with some criteria. We had one customer that took I think 23 criteria and tested 32 middlewares over a period of years. Ended up with DDS, obviously, why they're our customer, but those kinds of decisions, I think you can get a big head start on by some experience that we have out there in that webinar, number two. Number three really took a deeper look at data-centric and device-centric integration, which are sort of the epitome of DDS, which is data-centric, and OPC UA, which is device. The OPC UA, people push back, it's not just devices, it's just components. So devices and HMIs and historians are software, but you're not likely to write a large new software application if you're a final integrator here. These things are different. They can be used for different things. They can also be put together. We have an architecture that's part of the IIC's work and other work too. Put them together. And then, you know, why a data bus is a whole part four. You really want to understand why it's different, you know, what that mindset change is, take a look at that. Security is a huge problem. The IT kinds of securities you've heard of, like firewalls and whitelisting and network type transit, you know, network encryption and, you know, VPNs and things are all important, but they're all sort of bolted on in industrial setting. DES and data flow, data centric things can, because it's data centric, it can use a different kind of security we call data flow security that fits the architecture very nicely. It doesn't require any code, something you should definitely take a look at. And then we took a deep example into autonomous vehicles, what I call CarBots, and I really took a look at why this market is just flocking to DDS in many different ways, because it allows you to have a virtual shared memory environment, really the way that highly intelligent systems need access to lots of different kinds of data. And so your kids may not drive, may not compose music, and they may not write, but they are going to live in a very different world. They're going to live in a cleaner world, that's a safer world, more efficient world, that, you know, a much better place in a lot of ways. If you're trying to navigate this transition, I love this quote by John Chambers, you don't compete against competitors, you compete against market transitions. Many companies in many industries are going to be put out of business if they don't move here quick enough. And my sort of message throughout this whole series has been common architecture. It's really about the application space, not the application problems, not the industry you're in, really makes a big difference. It's very profound, and you have to watch the whole series to figure that out. I will end with, I do think the IoT is a trillion-dollar thesis, and my kid, when he was younger, I asked him if he would help me with work. I said, well, you have to do it. I said, I'll take you to the ice cream store. I said, okay. but, you know, it really is a trillion-dollar thesis. There's many different kinds of ice cream out there. You can choose any one of them. They're all great. But you have to sort of embrace this idea that future is smart machines is going to change everything, and you have your challenge. The ice cream is melting. You can't wait forever. Choose wisely, but choose now. Find your link to Things That Think, my little sound bite there. We have plenty of other information. Started out with an ebook. You can still get the ebooks on our site. It's actually just more information in the webinars, the ebook, lots of deeper stuff. Of course, give a plug to our website. Lots of great stuff there. And if you want to talk to me, that's the way to talk to me. Easiest on email or LinkedIn. Very much pay attention to all those kinds of things. And with that, I'll hand it back to Kurt. There's a couple minutes we have left.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Jam-packed presentation of a whole bunch of really good information. Unfortunately, we don't have time for Q&A, but I do want to let you know you can reach out to contact RTI directly with your questions. This brings us to the conclusion of today's webcast. I want to thank Stan for sharing your insights on the not-so-distant smart machine world future, and also for the previous six parts as well. We at Open Systems Media and RTI want to thank you, the audience, for attending today. The webcast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords Open Systems Media Events and find all of Open Systems Media webcasts available for download as MP3s, including the previous six parts. Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thanks for attending. Have a great day.
Thank you.